final volume of The Life of the Triarch Bellicho, a famous Volantine patriot whose unbroken succession of conquests and triumphs ended rather abruptly when he was eaten by giants. Tyrion had finished them all by their third day at sea. Then, for lack of any other books, he started reading them again. The slave girl's story was the worst written, but the most engrossing. And that was the one he took down this evening to see him through a supper of buttered beets, cold fish stew, and biscuits that could have been used to drive nails. He was reading the girl's account of the day she and her sister were taken by slavers when Penny entered the gallery.
"Oh," she said, "I thought I did not mean to disturb, my lord.
You're not disturbing me. You're not going to try to kill me again, I hope?"
"No."
She looked away, her face reddening. "In that case, I would welcome some company. There's little enough aboard this ship." Tyrion closed the book. "Come, sit, eat." The girl had left most of her meals untouched outside her cabin door. By now she must be starving. "The stew is almost edible. The fish is fresh, at least."
"No, I choked on a fish bone once. I can't eat fish."
"Have some wine, then." He filled a cup and slid it toward her. "Compliments of our captain. Closer to piss than Arbor Gold, if truth be told. But even piss tastes better than the black tar rum the sailors drink. It might help you sleep." The girl made no move to touch the cup.
"Thank you, my lord, but no."
She backed away.
"I should not be bothering you."
"Do you mean to spend your whole life running away?" Tyrion asked, before she could slip back out the door. That stopped her. Her cheeks turned a bright pink, and he was afraid she was about to start weeping again. Instead, she thrust out her lip defiantly and said,
"You're running too."
"I am," he confessed, "but I'm running too, and you are running from. And there's a world of difference there."
"We would never have had to run at all but for you."
"It took some courage to say that to my face."
"Are you speaking of King's Landing or Volantis?"
"Both."
Tears glistened in her eyes.
"Everything. Why couldn't you just come joust with us the way the king wanted? You wouldn't have gotten hurt. What would that have cost, my lord, to climb up on our dog and ride a tilt to please the boy? It was just a bit of fun. They would have laughed at you, that's all."
"They would have laughed at me," said Tyrion. "I made them laugh at Joff instead. And wasn't that a clever ploy?"
"My brother says that is a good thing, making people laugh, a noble thing, an honourable. My brother says he—"
The tears fell then, rolling down her face. "I am sorry about your brother." Tyrion had said the same words to her before, back in Volantis, but she was so far gone in grief back there that he doubted she had heard them. She heard them now.
"Sorry? You are sorry?"
Her lip was trembling. Her cheeks were wet. Her eyes were red-rimmed holes.
"We left King's Landing that very night. My brother said it was for the best, before someone wondered if we'd had some part in the king's death, and decided to torture us to find out. We went to Tyrosh first. My brother thought that would be far enough, but it wasn't. We knew a juggler there. For years and years he would juggle every day by the fountain of the drunken god. He was old, so his hands were not as deft as they had been, and sometimes he would drop his balls and chase them across the square. But the Tyroshi would laugh and throw him coins all the same. But one morning we heard that his body had been found at the Temple of Trios. Trios has three heads, and there's a big statue of him beside the temple doors. The old man had been cut into three parts and pushed inside the threefold mouths of Trios. Only when the parts were sewn back together, his head was gone."
"A gift for my sweet sister," He was another dwarf.
A little man, aye, like you. And Uppo, Groat. Are you sorry about the juggler too?
I never knew your juggler existed until this very moment.
But yes,
I am sorry he is dead.
He died for you. His blood is on your hands.
The accusation stung, coming so hard on the heels of Jorah Mormont's words. His blood is on my sister's hands, and the hands of the brutes who killed him. My hands. Tyrion turned them over, inspected them, coiled them into fists. My hands are crusted with old blood. I call me Kinslayer, and you won't be wrong. Kingslayer, I'll answer to that one as well. I have killed mothers, fathers, nephews, lovers, men and women, kings and whores. A singer once annoyed me, so I had the bastard stewed. But I have never killed a juggler, nor a dwarf, and I am not to blame for what happened to your bloody brother. Penny picked up the cup of wine he'd poured for her and threw it in his face. Just like my sweet sister. He heard the galley door slam, but never saw her leave. His eyes were stinging, and the world was a blur. So much for befriending her. Tyrion Lannister had scant experience with other dwarfs. His lord father had not welcomed any reminders of his son's deformities, and such mummers as featured little folk in their troops soon learned to stay away from Lannisport and Castle Rock, at the risk of his displeasure. Growing up, Tyrion heard reports of a dwarf jester at the seat of the Dornish Lord Fowler, a dwarf maester in service on the Fingers, and a female dwarf amongst the Silent Sisters, but he never felt the least need to seek them out. Less reliable tales also reached his ears of a dwarf witch who haunted a hill in the Riverlands, and a dwarf whore in King's Landing, renowned for coupling with dogs. His own sweet sister had told him of the last, even offering to find him a bitch in heat if he cared to try it out. When he asked politely if she were referring to herself, Cersei had thrown a cup of wine in his face. "That was red, as I recalled, and this is gold." Tyrion mopped at his face with a sleeve, his eyes still stung. He did not see Penny again until the day of the storm. The salt air lay still and heavy that morning, but the western sky was a fiery red, streaked with lowering clouds that glowed as bright as Lannister crimson. Sailors were dashing about, battening hatches, running lines, clearing the decks, lashing down everything that was not already lashed down. "Bad wind coming," one warned him. "No nose should get below." Tyrion remembered the storm he'd suffered, crossing the narrow sea, the way the deck had jumped beneath his feet, the hideous creaking sounds the ship had made, the taste of wine and vomit. "No nose will stay up here." If the guards wanted him, he would sooner die by drowning than choking on his own vomit. And overhead, the cog's canvas sail rippled slowly, like the fur of some great beast stirring from a long sleep, then filled with a sudden crack that turned every head on the ship. The winds drove the cog before them, far off her chosen course. Behind them, black clouds piled one atop another against a blood-red sky. By mid-morning, they could see lightning flickering to the west, followed by the distant crash of thunder. The sea grew rougher, and dark waves rose up to smash against the hull of the Stinky Steward. It was about then that the crew started hauling down the canvas. Tyrion was underfoot, amidships, so he climbed the forecastle and hunkered down, savouring the lash of cold rain on his cheeks. The cog went up and down, bucking more wildly than any horse he'd ever ridden, lifting with each wave before sliding down into the troughs between, jarring him to the bones. Even so, it was better here where he could see, than down below, locked in some airless cabin. By the time the storm broke, evening was upon them, and Tyrion Lannister was soaked through to the small clothes, yet somehow he felt elated, and even more so later, when he found a drunken Jorah Mormont in a pool of vomit in their cabin. The dwarf lingered in the galley after supper, celebrating his survival by sharing a few tots of black tar rum with the ship's cook, a great, greasy, loutish volantine who spoke only one word of the common tongue, fuck, but played a ferocious game of Sivas, particularly when drunk. They played three games that night. Tyrion won the first, then lost the other two. After that he decided that he'd had enough and stumbled back up on deck to clear his head of rum and elephants alike. He found Penny on the forecastle, where he had so often found Ser Jorah, standing by the rail beside the cog's hideous, half-rotted figurehead and gazing out across the inky sea. From behind, she looked as small and vulnerable as a child. Tyrion thought it best to leave her undisturbed, but it was too late. She had heard him. "Hugo Hill? If you like. We both know better. I am sorry to intrude on you. I will retire." "No." Her face was pale and sad, but she did not look to have been crying. "I'm sorry, too, about the wine. It wasn't you who killed my brother, or that poor old man in Tyrosh."
"I played a part, though not by choice."
"I miss him so much. My brother, I
understand." He found himself thinking of Jamie. "Count yourself lucky. Your brother died before he could betray you."
"I thought I wanted to die," she said. "But today, when the storm came and I thought the ship would sink, I...
"You realized that you wanted to leave after all." "I have been there too." "Something else we have in common." Her teeth were crooked, which made her shy with her smiles. But she smiled now.
"Did you truly cook a singer in the stew?"
"Who, me? No, I do not cook." When Penny giggled, she sounded like the sweet young girl she was. 17, 18, no more than 19.
"What did he do, this singer?"
"He wrote a song about me."
"For she was his secret treasure. She was his shame and his bliss, and a chain and a keep are nothing compared to a woman's kiss."
It was queer how quick the words came back to him. Perhaps they had never left him.
"Hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm."
"It must have been a very bad song."
"Not really. It was no Rains of Castamere, mind you. But some parts were, well..."
"How did it go?"
He laughed. "No, you do not want to hear me sing."
"My mother used to sing to us when we were children, my brother and me. She always said that it didn't matter what your voice was like, so long as you loved the song." "Was she a little person?" "No, but our father was. His own father sold him to a slaver when he was three. But he grew up to be such a famous mummer that he bought his freedom. He travelled to all the free cities and Westeros as well. In Old Town, they used to call him Hopbean."
"Of course they did." Tyrion tried not to wince.
"He's dead now," Penny went on. "My mother, too. Oppo, he was my last family. And now he's gone, too."
She turned her head away and gazed out across the sea.
"What will I do? Where will I go? I have no trade, just the jousting show. And that needs two."
"No," thought Tyrion, "that is not a place you want to go, girl. Do not ask that of me. Do not even think it." "Find yourself some likely orphan boy," he suggested. Penny did not seem to hear that.
It was my father's idea to do the tilts. He even trained the first pig. But by then he was too sick to ride her, so Uppo took his place. I always rode the dog. We performed for the Sea Lord of Bravas once, and he laughed so hard that afterwards he gave each of us a grand gift.
Is that where my sister found you? In Bravas?
Your sister?
The girl looked lost. Queen Cersei. Penny shook her head.
She never. It was a man who came to us in Pentos. Osmond? No, Oswald. Something like that. Uppo met with him, not me. Uppo made all of our arrangements. My brother always knew what to do, where we should go next.
Meereen is where we're going next.
She gave him a puzzled look. Carth, you mean? We're bound for Carth, by way of New Giss.
Meereen, you'll ride your dog for the Dragon Queen and come away with your weight in gold. Best start eating more, so you'll be nice and plump when you joust before her grace. Penny did not return the smile.
By myself, all I can do is ride round in circles. And even if the Queen should laugh, where will I go afterwards? We never stay in one place long. The first time they see us, they laugh and laugh, but by the fourth or fifth time, they know what we're going to do before we do it. Then they stop laughing, so we have to go somewhere new. We make the most coin in the big cities, but I always like the little towns the best. Places like that, the people have no silver, but they feed us at their own tables, and the children follow us everywhere.
That's because they've never seen a dwarf before in their wretched pisspot towns, Tyrion thought. The bloody brats would follow around a two-headed goat if one turned up, until they got bored with its bleating and slaughtered it for supper. But he had no wish to make her weep again, so instead he said, "Daenerys has a kind heart and a generous nature." It was what she needed to hear. "She will find a place for you at her court, I don't doubt, a safe place beyond my sister's reach." Penny turned back to him.
"And you will be there too?"
"Unless Daenerys decides she needs some Lannister blood to pay for the Targaryen blood my brother shed, I will." After that, the dwarf girl was seen more frequently above deck. The next day, Tyrion encountered her and her spotted sow amidships in mid-afternoon, when the air was warm and the sea calm.
"Her name is Pretty,"
the girl told him shyly. Pretty the pig and Penny the girl, he thought. Someone has a deal to answer for. Penny gave Tyrion some acorns, and he let Pretty eat them from his hand. "Do not think I don't see what you're doing, girl," he thought, as the big sow snuffled and squealed. Soon they began to take their meals together. Some nights it was just the two of them. At other meals, they crowded in with Macoro's guards. "The Fingers," Tyrion called them. They were men of the fiery hand, after all. And there were five of them. Penny laughed at that. A sweet sound, though not one he heard often. Her wound was too fresh, her grief too deep. He soon had her calling the ship the Stinky Steward, though she got somewhat wroth with him whenever he called Pretty Bacon. To return for that, Tyrion made an attempt to teach her Sivers, though he soon realized that was a lost cause. "No," he said a dozen times, "the dragonflies, not the elephants." That same night, she came right out and asked him if he would like to tilt with her. "No," he answered. Only later did it occur to him that perhaps tilt did not mean tilt. His answer would still have been no, but he might not have been so brusque. Back in the cabin he shared with Jorah Mormont, Tyrion twisted in his hammock for hours, slipping in and out of sleep. His dreams were full of grey, stony hands reaching for him from out of the fog, and a stair that led up to his father.
Finally, he gave it up and made his way up top for a breath of night air. The Salisaurikoran had furled her big striped sail for the night, and her decks were all but deserted. One of the mates was on the stern castle, and amidships, Makoro sat by his brazier, where a few small flames still danced amongst the embers. Only the brightest stars were visible, all to the west. A dull red glow lit the sky to the northeast, the colour of a blood bruise. Tyrion had never seen a bigger moon, monstrous, swollen. It looked as if it had swallowed the sun and woken with a fever. Its twin, floating on the sea beyond the ship, shimmered red with every wave. "What hour is this?" he asked Makoro. "That cannot be sunrise, unless the east has moved. Why is the sky red?"
"The sky is always red above Valyria, Hugo Hill."
A cold chill went down his back. "Are we close?"
"Closer than the crew would like,"
Makoro said in his deep voice.
"Do you know the stories in your sunset kingdoms? I know some sailors say that any man who lays eyes upon that coast is doomed."
He did not believe such tales himself, no more than his uncle had. Jerry and Lannister had set sail for Valyria when Tyrion was 18, intent on recovering the lost ancestral blade of House Lannister and any other treasures that might have survived the doom. Tyrion had wanted desperately to go with them, but his lord father had dubbed the voyage a fool's quest and forbidden him to take part. And perhaps he was not so wrong. Almost a decade had passed since the Laughing Lion headed out from Lannisport, and Geryon had never returned. The men Lord Tywin sent to seek after him had traced his course as far as Valentis, where half his crew had deserted him, and he had bought slaves to replace them. No free man would willingly sign aboard a ship whose captain spoke openly of his intent to sail into the Smoking Sea. "So those are fires of the 14 flames we're seeing, reflected on the clouds."
14 or 14,000, what man dares count them? Is not wise for mortals to look too deeply at those fires, my friend. Those are fires of God's own wrath, and no human flame can match them. We are small creatures, men.
Some smaller than others. Valyria. It was written that on the day of doom every hill for 500 miles had split asunder, to fill the air with ash and smoke and fire, blazes so hot and hungry that even the dragons in the sky were engulfed and consumed. Great rents had opened in the earth, swallowing palaces, temples, entire towns. Lakes boiled or turned to acid. Mountains burst. Fiery fountains spewed molten rock 1,000 feet into the air. Red clouds rained down dragon glass and the black blood of demons. And to the north the ground splintered and collapsed and fell in on itself, and an angry sea came rushing in. The proudest city in all the world was gone in an instant. Its fabled empire vanished in a day. The lands of the long summer scorched and drowned and blighted. An empire built on blood and fire. The Valyrians reap the seed they had sown. Does our captain mean to test the curse?
Our captain would prefer to be 50 leagues further out to sea, well away from that accursed shore. But I have commanded him to steer the shortest course. Others seek Daenerys too.
Griff with his young prince. Could all that talk of the Golden Company sailing west have been a feint? Tyrion considered saying something, then thought better. It seemed to him that the prophecy that drove the Red Priests had room for just one hero. A second Targaryen would only serve to confuse them.
"Have you seen these others in your fires?" he asked wearily.
"Only their shadows," Makoro said. "One most of all, a tall and twisted thing with one black eye and 10 long arms, sailing on a sea of blood."
Arya. Her eyes had grown accustomed to blackness. When Harwin pulled the hood off her head, the ruddy glare inside the hollow hill made Arya blink like some stupid owl. A huge fire pit had been dug in the center of the earthen floor, and its flames rose, swirling and crackling, toward the smoke-stained ceiling. The walls were equal parts of stone and soil, with huge white roots twisting through them like 1,000 slow, pale snakes. People were emerging from between those roots as she watched, edging out from the shadows for a look at the captives, stepping from the mouths of pitch-black tunnels, popping out of crannies and crevices on all sides. In one place, on the far side of the fire, the roots formed a kind of stairway up to a hollow in the earth where a man sat, almost lost in the tangle of weirwood. Lem unhooded Gendry.
"What is this place?" he asked.
"An old place, deep and secret, a refuge where neither wolves nor lions come prowling."
"Neither wolves nor lions?"
Arya's skin prickled. She remembered the dream she'd had and the taste of blood when she tore the man's arm from his shoulder. Big as the fire was, the cave was bigger. It was hard to tell where it began and where it ended. The tunnel mouths might have been 2 feet deep or gone on 2 miles. Arya saw men and women and little children, all of them watching her warily. Greenbeard said,
"Here's the wizard, Skinny Squirrel. You'll get your answers now."
He pointed to the fire where Tom Sevenstrings stood talking to a tall, thin man with oddments of old armour buckled on over his ratty pink robes.
"That can't be Thoris of Myr."
Arya remembered the Red Priest as fat, with a smooth face and a shiny bald head. This man had a droopy face and a full head of shaggy grey hair. Something Tom said made him look at her, and Arya thought he was about to come over to her. Only then the mad huntsman appeared, shoving his captive down into the light, and she and Gendry were forgotten. The huntsman had turned out to be a stocky man in patched tanned leathers, balding and weak-chinned and quarrelsome. At Stony Sept she had thought that Lem and Greenbeard might be torn to pieces when they faced him at the crow cages to claim his captive for the Lightning Lord. The hounds had been all around them, sniffing and snarling, but Thomas Sevens soothed them with his playing. Tansy marched across the square with her apron full of bones and fatty mutton, and Lem pointed out Angai in the brothel window, standing with an arrow notched. The mad huntsman had cursed them all for lickspittles, but finally he had agreed to take his prize to Lord Beric for judgment. They had bound his wrists with hempen rope, strung a noose around his neck, and pulled a sack down over his head. But even so, there was danger in the man. Arya could feel it across the cave. Thoris, if that was Thoris, met captor and captive halfway to the fire.
"How did you take him?"
the priest asked.
"The dogs caught the scent. He was sleeping off a drunk under a willow tree, if you believe it."
"Betrayed by his own kind."
Thoris turned to the prisoner and yanked his hood off.
"Welcome to our humble hall, dog. It is not so grand as Robert's throne room, but the company is better."
The shifting flames painted Sandor Clegane's burned face with orange shadows, so he looked even more terrible than he did in daylight. When he pulled at the rope that bound his wrists, flakes of dry blood fell off. The hound's mouth twitched.
"I know you,"
he said to Thoris.
"You did. In melees, you cursed my flaming sword, though thrice I overthrew you with it."
"Thoris of Myr, you used to shave your head."
"To betoken a humble heart, but in truth my heart was vain.
Besides, I lost my razor in the woods. The priest slapped his belly. I am less than I was, but more. A year in the wild will melt the flesh off a man. Would that I could find a tailor to take in my skin. I might look young again, and pretty maids would shower me with kisses. Only the blind ones, priest. The outlaws hooted, none so loud as Thoris. Just so. Yet I am not the false priest you knew. The Lord of Light has woken in my heart. Many powers long asleep are waking, and there are forces moving in the land. I have seen them in my flames. The hound was unimpressed. Bugger your flames, and you as well. He looked around at the others. You keep queer company for a holy man. These are my brothers, Thoris said simply. Lem Lemoncloak pushed forward. He and Greenbeard were the only men there tall enough to look the hound in the eye. Be careful how you bark, dog. We hold your life in our hands. Best wipe the shit off your fingers, then, the hound laughed. How long have you been hiding in this hole? Angai the archer bristled at the suggestion of cowardice.
Ask the goat if we've hidden, hound. Ask your brother. Ask the Lord of Leeches. We've blooded them all.
You lot, don't make me laugh. You look more swineherds than soldiers.
Some of us were swineherds, said a short man Arya did not know. And some was tanners or singers or masons, but that was before the war come.
When we left King's Landing, we were men of Winterfell and men of Derry and men of Blackhaven, Mallory men and wild men. We were knights and squires and men-at-arms, lords and commoners bound together only by our purpose.
The voice came from the man seated amongst the weirwood roots halfway up the wall.
60 of us set out to bring the king's justice to your brother.
The speaker was descending the tangle of steps toward the floor.
60 brave men and true, led by a fool in a starry cloak.
A scarecrow of a man, he wore a ragged black cloak speckled with stars and an iron breastplate dinted by 100 battles. A thicket of red gold hair hid most of his face, save for a bald spot above his left ear where his head had been smashed in.
More than 80 of our company are dead now, but others have taken up the swords that fell from their hands.
When he reached the floor, the outlaws moved aside to let him pass. One of his eyes was gone, Arya saw. The flesh about the socket scarred and puckered, and he had a dark black ring all around his neck.
With their help, we fight on as best we can for Robert and the realm.
Robert?
Ross Sandor Clegane, incredulous.
Ned Stark sent us out, said Pothelm Jack Be Lucky. But he was sitting the Iron Throne when he gave us our commands, so we were never truly his men, but Robert's.
Robert is a king of worms now. Is that why you're down in the earth, to keep his court for him?
The king is dead, the Scarecrow Knight admitted, but we are still king's men, though the royal banner we bore was lost at the Mummer's Ford when your brother's butchers fell upon us.
He touched his breast with a fist.
Robert is slain, but his realm remains, and we defend her.
Her? The hound snorted. Is she your mother, Dondarrion, or your whore?
Dondarrion.
Beric Dondarrion had been handsome. Sansa's friend Jane had fallen in love with him. Even Jane Poole was not so blind as to think this man was fair. Yet when Arya looked at him again, she saw it. The remains of a forked purple lightning bolt on the cracked enamel of his breastplate.
Rocks and trees and rivers, that's what your realm is made of,
the hound was saying.
Do the rocks need defending? Robert wouldn't have thought so. If he couldn't fuck it, fight it, or drink it, it bored him. And so would you, you brave companions.
Outrage swept the hollow hill.
Call us that name again, dog, and you'll swallow that tongue.
Lem drew his longsword. The hound stared at the blade with contempt.
Here's a brave man. Bearing steel on a bound captive? Untie me, why don't you?
We'll see how brave you are then.
He glanced at the mad huntsman behind him.
How about you? Or did you leave all your courage in your kennels? No, but I should have left you in a crow cage.
The huntsman drew a knife.
I might still.
The hound laughed in his face.
We are brothers here, Thoros of Myr declared. Holy brothers, sworn to the realm, to our god, and to each other.
The brotherhood without banners, Tom Sevenstrings plucked a string. The knights of the Hollow Hill.
Knights? Clegane made the word a sneer. Dondarrion's a knight, but the rest of you all are the sorriest lot of outlaws and broken men I've ever seen. I shit better men than you.
Any knight can make a knight, said the scarecrow that was Beric Dondarrion. And every man you see before you has felt a sword upon his shoulder. We are the Forgotten Fellowship.
Send me on my way, and I'll forget you too, Clegane rasped. But if you mean to murder me, then bloody well get on with it. You took my sword, my horse, and my gold, so take my life and be done with it. But spare me this pious bleating.
You will die soon enough, dog, promised Thoros. But it shan't be murder, only justice.
Aye, said the mad huntsman, and a kinder fate than you deserve for all your kind have done. Lions, you call yourselves. At Shara and the Mummer's Ford, girls of 6 and 7 years were raped, and babes still on the breast were cut in two while their mothers watched. No lion ever killed so cruel.
I was not at Shara, nor the Mummer's Ford, the hound told him. Lay your dead children at some other door.
Thoros answered him. Do you deny that House Clegane was built upon dead children? I saw them lay Prince Aegon and Princess Rhaenys before the Iron Throne. By rights, your arm should bear 2 bloody infants in place of those ugly dogs. The hound's mouth twitched.
Do you take me for my brother? Is being born Clegane a crime?
Murder is a crime.
Who did I murder?
Lord Lothar Mallory and Sir Gladden Wild, said Harwin.
My brothers Lister and Lennox, declared Jack Belucky.
Goodman Beck and Mudge the Miller's son from Dunnelwood,
an old woman called from the shadows.
Merryman's widow, who loves so sweet, said Greenbeard.
Them Septons at Sludgy Pond.
Sir Andre Charlton, Esquire Lucas Root, every man, woman, and child in Fieldstone and Mousedown Mill.
Lord and Lady Deddings, that were so rich.
Tom Sevenstrings took up the count.
Eleanor Winterfell, Joth Quickbow, Little Matt and his sister Rander, Anvil Rin, Sir Armand, Sir Dudley, Pate of Murray, Pate of Lancewood, Old Pate and Pate of Shermer's Grove, Blind Will the Whittler, Goodwife Mary, Mary the Whore, Becker the Baker, Sir Raymond Derry, Lord Derry, Young Lord Derry, the Bastard of Brecon, Fletcher of Will, Harsley, Goodwife Noler.
Enough!
The hound's face was tight with anger.
You're making noise. These names mean nothing. Who were they?
People, said Lord Beric. People, great and small, young and old, good people and bad people, who died on the points of Lannister spears or saw their bellies opened by Lannister swords.
It wasn't my sword in their bellies. Any man who says it was is a bloody liar.
You serve the Lannisters of Castle Rock, said Thoros.
Once, me and thousands more. Is each of us guilty of the crimes of the others?
Clegane spat.
Might be you are knights, after all. You lie like knights, and maybe you murder like knights.
Lem and Jack Belucky began to shout at him, but Dondarrion raised a hand for silence.
See what you mean, Clegane.
A knight's a sword with a horse. The rest, the vows, and the sacred oils, and the ladies' favours, they're silk ribbons tied around the sword. Maybe the sword's prettier with ribbons hanging off it, but it would kill you just as dead. Well, bugger your ribbons, and shove your swords up your asses. I'm the same as you. The only difference is, I don't lie about what I am. So kill me. but don't call me a murderer while you stand there telling each other that your shit don't stink. You hear me?"
Arya squirted past Greenbeard so fast he never saw her.
"You are a murderer," she screamed. "You killed Micah. Don't say you never did. You murdered him."
The hound stared at her with no flicker of recognition.
"And who was this Micah boy?"
"I'm not a boy, but Micah was. He was a butcher's boy, and you killed him. Jorah said you cut him near in half, and he never even had a sword."
She could feel them looking at her now, the women and the children and the men who call themselves the Knights of the Hollow Hill.
"Who's this now?"
someone asked. The hound answered,
"Seven elves. The little sister, the brat who tossed Joff's pretty sword in the river."
He gave a bark of laughter.
"Don't you know you're dead?"
"No, you're dead," she threw back at him. Harwin took her arm to draw her back as Lord Beric said,
"The girl has named you a murderer. Do you deny killing this butcher's boy, Micah?"
The big man shrugged.
"I was Joffrey's sworn shield. The butcher's boy attacked a prince of the blood."
"That's a lie."
Arya squirmed in Harwin's grip.
"It was me. I hit Joffrey and threw Lion's Paw in the river. Micah just ran away like I told him."
"Did you see the boy attack Prince Joffrey?"
Lord Beric Dondarrion asked the hound.
"I heard it from the royal lips. It's not my place to question princes."
Clegane jerked his hands towards Arya.
"This one's own sister told the same tale when she stood before your precious Robert."
"Sansa's just a liar," Arya said, furious at her sister all over again.
"It wasn't like she said, it wasn't."
Thoros drew Lord Beric aside. The two men stood talking in low whispers while Arya seethed.
"They have to kill him. I prayed for him to die hundreds and hundreds of times."
Beric Dondarrion turned back to the hound.
"You stand accused of murder, but no one here knows the truth or falsehood of the charge, so it is not for us to judge you. Only the Lord of Light may do that now. I sentence you to trial by battle."
The hound frowned suspiciously, as if he did not trust his ears.
"Are you a fool or a madman?"
"Neither. I am a just lord. Prove your innocence with a blade, and you shall be free to go."
"No,"
Arya cried before Harwin covered her mouth.
"No, they can't. He'll go free."
The hound was deadly with a sword. Everyone knew that.
"He'll laugh at them," she thought.
And so he did. A long, rasping laugh that echoed off the cave walls, a laugh choking with contempt.
"So, who will it be?"
He looked at Lem Lemoncloak.
"The brave man in the piss-yellow cloak?" "No." "Well, how about you, huntsman? You've kicked dogs before. Try me."
He saw Greenbeard.
"You're big enough. Tyrosh, step forward. Or do you mean to make the little girl fight me herself?"
He laughed again.
"Come on. Who wants to die?"
"It's me, your face," said Lord Beric Dondarrion.
Arya remembered all the tales.
"He can't be killed,"
she thought, hoping against hope. The mad huntsman sliced apart the ropes that bound Sandor Clegane's hands together.
"I'll need sword and armor."
The hound rubbed a torn wrist.
"Your sword you shall have," declared Lord Beric. "But your innocence must be your armor."
Clegane's mouth twitched.
"My innocence against your breastplate? Is that a way of it?"
"Ned, help me remove my breastplate."
Arya got goosebumps when Lord Beric said her father's name. But this Ned was only a boy, a fair-haired squire, no more than 10 or 12. He stepped up quickly to undo the clasps that fastened the battered steel about the marcher lord. The quilting beneath was rotten with age and sweat, and fell away when the metal was pulled loose. Gendry sucked in his breath.
"Mother have mercy!"
Lord Beric's ribs were outlined starkly beneath his skin. A puckered crater scarred his breast, just above his left nipple, and when he turned to call for sword and shield, Arya saw a matching scar upon his back. The lance went through him.
The hound had seen it too.
Is he scared?
Arya wanted him to be scared before he died, as scared as Micah must have been. Ned fetched Lord Beric his sword belt and a long black surcoat. It was meant to be worn over armour, so it draped his body loosely, but across it crackled the forked purple lightning of his house. He unsheathed his sword and gave the belt back to his squire. Thoros brought the hound his sword belt.
"Does a dog have honour?"
the priest asked.
"Lest you think to cut you away free of here, or seize some child for a hostage, Angai, Dennet, Kyle, feather him at the first sign of treachery."
Only when the three bowmen had notched their shafts did Thoros hand Clegane the belt. The hound ripped the sword free and threw away the scabbard. The mad huntsman gave him his oaken shield, all studded with iron and painted yellow, the three black dogs of Clegane emblazoned upon it. The boy Ned helped Lord Beric with his own shield, so hacked and battered that the purple lightning and the scatter of stars upon it had almost been obliterated. But when the hound made to step towards his foe, Thoros of Myr stopped him.
"First we pray."
He turned toward the fire and lifted his arms.
"Lord of light, look down upon us."
All around the cave, the Brotherhood, without banners, lifted their own voices in response.
"Lord of light, defend us. Lord of light, protect us in the darkness. Lord of light, shine your face upon us. Light your flame among us, R'hllor," said the Red Priest. "Show us the truth or falseness of this man. Strike him down if he is guilty, and give strength to his sword if he is true. Lord of light, give us wisdom."
"For the night is dark," the others chanted, Harwin and Angai loud as all the rest,
"and full of terrors."
"This cave is dark too," said the hound, "but I'm the terror here. I hope your guard's a sweet one, Dondarrion. You're going to meet him shortly."
Unsmiling, Lord Beric laid the edge of his longsword against the palm of his left hand and drew it slowly down. Blood ran dark from the gash he made and washed over the steel. And then the sword took fire. Arya heard Gendry whisper a prayer.
"Burn in seven hells," the hound cursed. "You and Thoros too."
He threw a glance at the Red Priest.
"When I'm done with him, you'll be next, Myr."
"Every word you say proclaims your guilt, dog," answered Thoros, while Lem and Greenbeard and Jack Bilocky shouted threats and curses.
Lord Beric himself waited silent, calm as still water, his shield on his left arm and his sword burning in his right hand.
"Kill him," Arya thought. "Please, you have to kill him."
Lit from below, his face was a death mask, his missing eye a red and angry wound. The sword was aflame from point to crossguard, but Dondarrion seemed not to feel the heat. He stood so still, he might have been carved of stone. But when the hound charged him, he moved fast enough. The flaming sword leapt up to meet the cold one, long streamers of fire trailing in its wake, like the ribbons the hound had spoken of. Steel rang on steel. No sooner was this first slash blocked than Clegane made another, but this time Lord Beric's shield got in the way, and wood chips flew from the force of the blow. Hard and fast the cuts came, from low and high, from right and left, and each one Dondarrion blocked. The flame swirled about his sword and left red and yellow ghosts to mark its passage. Each move Lord Beric made fanned them, and made them burn the brighter, until it seemed as though the Lightning Lord stood within a cage of fire.
"Is it wildfire?"
Arya asked Gendry.
"No, this is different. This is
magic,"
she finished as the hound edged back. Now it was Lord Beric attacking, filling the air with ropes of fire, driving the bigger man back on his heels. Clegane caught one blow high in his shield, and a painted dog lost a head. He countercut, and Dondarrion interposed his own shield and launched a fiery backslash. The outlaw brotherhood shouted on their leader,
"He's yours!"
Arya heard, and "At him! At him! At him!" The hound parried a cut at his head, grimaced as the heat of the flames beat against his face. He grunted and cursed and reeled away. Lord Beric gave him no respite. Hard on the big man's heels he followed, his arm never still. The swords clashed and sprang apart, and clashed again. Splinters flew from the lightning shield, while swirling flames kissed the dogs once and twice and thrice. The hound moved to his right, but Dondarrion blocked him with a quick sidestep and drove him back the other way, toward the sullen red blaze of the fire pit. Clegane gave ground until he felt the heat at his back. A quick glance over his shoulder showed him what was behind him, and almost cost him his head when Lord Beric attacked anew. Arya could see the whites of Sandor Clegane's eyes as he bulled his way forward again. Three steps up and two back, a move to the left that Lord Beric blocked. Two more forward and one back, clang and clang, and the big oaken shields took blow after blow after blow. The hound's lank dark hair was plastered to his brow in a sheen of sweat. Wine sweat, Arya thought, remembering that he'd been taken drunk. She thought she could see the beginnings of fear wake in his eyes. He's going to lose, she told herself, exulting, as Lord Beric's flaming sword whirled and slashed. In one wild flurry, the Lightning Lord took back all the ground the hound had gained, sending Clegane staggering to the very edge of the fire pit once more. He is, he's going to die. She stood on her toes for a better look. Bloody bastard! The hound screamed as he felt the fire licking against the back of his thighs. He charged, swinging the heavy sword harder and harder, trying to smash the smaller man down with brute force, to break blade or shield or arm. But the flames of Dondarrion's parries snapped at his eyes, and when the hound jerked away from them, his foot went out from under him and he staggered to one knee. At once Lord Beric closed, his downcut screaming through the air, trailing pennons of fire. Panting from exertion, Clegane jerked his shield up over his head just in time, and the cave rang with a loud crack of splintering oak.
"His shield is afire," Gendry said in a hushed voice.
Arya saw it in the same instant. The flames had spread across the chipped yellow paint, and the three black dogs were engulfed. Sandor Clegane had fought his way back to his feet with a reckless counterattack. Not until Lord Beric retreated apace did the hound seem to realize that the fire that roared so near his face was his own shield burning. With a shout of revulsion, he hacked down savagely on the broken oak, completing its destruction. The shield shattered, one piece of it spinning away still afire, while the other clung stubbornly to his forearm. His efforts to free himself only fanned the flames. His sleeve caught fire, and now his whole left arm was ablaze. "Finish him!" Greenbeard urged Lord Beric, and other voices took up the chant of, "Guilty!" Arya shouted with the rest, "Guilty! Guilty! Kill him! Guilty!" Smooth as summer silk, Lord Beric slid close to make an end of the man before him. The hound gave a rasping scream, raised his sword in both hands, and brought it crashing down with all his strength. Lord Beric blocked the cut easily.
"No!"
Arya shrieked, but the burning sword snapped in two, and the hound's cold steel ploughed into Lord Beric's flesh, where his shoulder joined his neck and clove him clean down to the breastbone. The blood came rushing out in a hot black gush. Sandor Clegane jerked backwards, still burning. He ripped the remnants of his shield off and flung them away with a curse, then rolled in the dirt to smother the fire running along his arm. Lord Beric's knees folded slowly, as if for prayer. When his mouth opened, only blood came out. The hound's sword was still in him as he toppled face forward. The dirt drank his blood. Beneath the hollow hill, there was no sound but the soft crackling of flames and the whimper the hound made when he tried to rise. Arya could only think of Micah and all the stupid prayers she'd prayed for the hound to die. If there were guards, why didn't Lord Beric win? She knew the hound was guilty.
"Please," Sandor Clegane rasped, cradling his arm. "I'm burned. Help me. Someone, help me."
He was crying.
"Please."
Arya looked at him in astonishment.
He's crying, like a little baby, she thought.
Millie, a see to his burns, said Thoros. Lem, Jack, help me with Lord Beric. Ned, you'd best come too.
The Red Priest wrenched the hound's sword from the body of his fallen lord and thrust the point of it down in the blood-soaked earth. Lem slid his big hands under Dondarrion's arms while Jack be Lucky took his feet. They carried him around the fire pit into the darkness of one of the tunnels. Thoros and the boy Ned followed after. The mad huntsman spat.
I say we take him back to Stony Sept and put him in a crow's cage.
Yes, Arya said. He murdered Micah. He did.
Such an angry squirrel, murmured Greenbeard.
Harwin sighed.
R'hllor has judged him innocent.
Who's R'hllor?
She couldn't even say it.
The Lord of Light, Thoros has taught us.
She didn't care what Thoros had taught them. She yanked Greenbeard's dagger from its sheath and spun away before he could catch her. Gendry made a grab for her as well, but she had always been too fast for Gendry. Tom Sevenstrings and some woman were helping the hound to his feet. The sight of his arm shocked her speechless. There was a strip of pink where the leather strap had clung. But above and below, the flesh was cracked and red and bleeding from elbow to wrist. When his eyes met hers, his mouth twitched.
You want me dead that bad? Then do it, wolf girl. Shove it in. It's cleaner than fire.
Clegane tried to stand, but as he moved, a piece of burned flesh sloughed right off his arm, and his knees went out from under him. Tom caught him by his good arm and held him up.
His arm, Arya thought, and his face. But he was the hound. He deserved to burn in a fiery hell. The knife felt heavy in her hand. She gripped it tighter.
You killed Micah, she said once more, daring him to deny it. Tell them you did it. You did. I did. His whole face twisted. I rode him down and cut him in half and laughed. I watched them beat your sister bloody too. Watched them cut your father's head off.
Lem grabbed her wrist and twisted, wrenching the dagger away. She kicked at him, but he would not give it back.
You go to hell, hound, she screamed at Sandor Clegane in helpless, empty-handed rage. You just go to hell.
He has, said a voice, scarce stronger than a whisper.
When Arya turned, Lord Beric Dondarrion was standing behind her, his bloody hand clutching Thoros by the shoulder.
Bran. The moon was a crescent, thin and sharp as a blade of a knife. A pale sun rose and set and rose again. Red leaves whispered in the wind. Dark clouds filled the skies and turned to storms. Lightning flashed and thunder rumbled, and dead men with black hands and bright blue eyes shuffled round a cleft in the hillside but could not enter. Under the hill, the broken boy sat upon a weirwood throne, listening to whispers in the dark as ravens walked up and down his arms. "You will never walk again," the three-eyed crow had promised, "but you will fly." Sometimes a sound of song would drift up from some place far below. The children of the forest, old Nan would have called the singers, but those who sing the song of earth was their own name for themselves, in the true tongue that no human could speak. The ravens could speak it, though. Their small black eyes were full of secrets, and they would caw at him and peck his skin when they heard the songs. The moon was fat and full. Stars wheeled across a black sky. Rain fell and froze, and tree limbs snapped from the weight of the ice. Bran and Mira made up names for those who sang the song of earth. Ash and leaf and scales, black knife and snowy locks and coals. Their true names were too long for human tongues, said Leaf. Only she could speak the common tongue, so what the others thought of their new names Bran never learnt. After the bone-grinding cold of the lands beyond the wall, the caves were blessedly warm, and when the chill crept out of the rock, the singers would light fires